Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for September 15th, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And later this half hour, we'll have cash grain analysis with the folks at the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news, still no word on when USDA will rule on whether to increase blending limits for ethanol. We'll have that and other stories this half hour. And in the second part of the show, the farming world, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for a conversation with Director of Illinois Rural Development, Colleen Callahan. It's all on the Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Here's how prices settled Wednesday afternoon in Kansas City and Chicago. In Kansas City, December wheat 7.59 and three quarters, down 6.5. March 7.72 and a half, down 7. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 7.26 and three quarters, down 9.25. March 7.56 and a half, down 8.5. December corn 4.95 and a quarter, up a quarter. March 5.08 and a half, up a quarter. May 5.13 and a quarter, up 1 3/4, July 5.17 up 2 3/4, September 4.89 and a half up 4.5, November beans 10.42 and a half up 7, January 10.52 and 3/4 up 7.5, March 10.60 and 3/4 up 7.25, May 10.63 and 3/4 up 6 3/4, October soybean meal 2.94.50 up 80, December 2.97.70 up 1.20, October soybean oil 41.61 up 28. October live cattle 98.12 and a half, down 7.5. September feeders 111.80, down 35. October lean hogs 79.25, up 55. And those are Wednesday's settlements in Kansas City and in Chicago.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says showers are likely in the northwestern Corn Belt Thursday afternoon and Friday, with rainfall of up to 0.3 inches. Showers are likely again Saturday into Sunday in the lower western Corn Belt and most of the eastern Midwest, where moisture totals will be under 0.4 inches. Rain will return to the western Corn Belt again Monday and Tuesday, with some of the moisture reaching eastern areas Tuesday into Wednesday of next week. Frost and a few freezes are likely in northwestern parts of the Corn Belt this weekend. Lows in the 30s are most likely, with a few extremes in the upper 20s just south of the Canadian border in North Dakota and northern Minnesota. Daily high temperatures over the coming week will stay warm in the lower Midwest, with 70 and 80 degree highs occurring often.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, rack it up to 12 of 14 days that December futures in corn have made new highs, although for a while there it was touch and go, but a quarter is a quarter.
You betcha. And, of course, from a statistician's point of view, that's a pretty steep hill to climb, and we're seeing it here on September 15th.
So the question is where the top of the hill is, and is it around the $5 level, or is it something a little bit higher?
Well, a couple things we do know about. You know, we are anticipating good exports in corn. There still continues to be disappointment. Marketing services have a tendency to sell quite a bit, and my feeling is that they've sold quite a bit, and the farmers are selling a lot of grain, and the market's just gobbling that up like it was water. We do know that west of Mississippi, there's quite a bit of rain in the forecast, and at the same time, we're going to see a pretty definite cold shot that definitely is going to affect the Canadian prairies and the canola crop, and also parts of the upper Midwest and soybeans. And when I talked to a river station there in Minnesota, they said there would be some damage, possibly. And there's definitely a lot of questions and concerns about the Canadian prairies. It's a big canola crop. And, of course, oil seeds did perform pretty good today, particularly oil.
So when I listen to all that you just said, I don't hear no negative fundamental news in that.
Well, the negative news is, of course, as you mentioned, how much more corn would be for sale if it does close above $5. There's an enormous amount of corn yet to move over the scales. We know that the farmers have upgraded machinery and elevators have upgraded. We're seeing corn go on the ground. But with large carries in the market, tremendous export demand, and the ability, and they basically know how to handle putting corn on the ground better than they did 25 to 30 years ago. But the wonderful thing about this is that we have some demand, not only export, but some good domestic usage with renewable energies called ethanol and corn sweeteners.
You mentioned demand a couple of times. Tomorrow, of course, we get export sales reports. Do we need to see something fairly stout to keep this rally going?
Our impression is that there is all reports indicate that the exporters have big books on, and I think it would be betting on the wrong horse if we bet against something changing there.
Farmers are really going to town with getting the corn crop harvested. What do you think the numbers will show next Monday? Maybe something in the 30s, mid-30s nationally?
In the Oakland area, between Oakland and Danville, definitely we're seeing more harvesting, south of 36. And, of course, in the Homer area, we're seeing a tremendous push for corn harvest. When I talk about the corn in the Ottawa area, we get the feeling, it's still carrying some moisture. But around here, it's unbelievable. When you hear 15, 14, 16% moisture, there's only one thing you could do is push the combine at full throttle and harvest as many acres, and we are getting a ton of corn. To answer your question, it'll be a lot, and, of course, it's more so east of the Mississippi.
What are traders in Chicago thinking about the current state of the rally?
Well, of course, when the open outcry, and the computer trade, and I was just talking to a floor person this morning about that, is the advantage is the computer screen, and the people in Chicago not necessarily has the mystique to have any more insight in anything than someone sitting in Champaign, Illinois. But the general feeling is, I think, from industry-wide is that we have a very dynamic market in corn, soybeans, and wheat now, and we're also painting a picture that with the need to buy acreage with increased wheat plantings, the possibility of a weather problem emerging with a La Nina in South America, particularly Brazil, the focus is that we do have a fairly dynamic market. We've got some outside commodities that are acting extremely well. And also you add to that that the concern that industry and even some of our world users are still short bought. So this all adds up that we do have a fairly dynamic market. I hope the fear is that we don't get too high to where we hurt certain industries like the livestock. I don't think that's in the realm of possibilities yet, but I hope it doesn't get too high to hurt those people.
Let's turn our attention to the soybeans, which technically bounced off the 1025 area and is looking like that's a place for pretty good support.
Yeah, I think it's no secret any longer that we do have a good yield on soybeans. We did get a report that some 55-bushel producing ground in Iowa that has sudden death is 46 bushels an acre being harvested. I question whether the USDA actually found that sudden death syndrome in their big 51-bushel bin buster crop out in Iowa. But needless to say, the Chinese demand is good. Soybean oil is actually as cheap as palm oil. That's a demand factor, and the problem is nobody in the Pacific Rim, and also we lost tons of sunflower with the Russians. And all this adds up to a pretty dynamic market in the oilseed market, and we'll probably have 3 to 4 million acres less soybean acres planted next year, and that doesn't augur for cheap soybean prices in the third place.
Not only less soybean acres perhaps next year, but how about less either planted and or harvested acres on the October report, maybe as many as 500,000?
Well, you know, there's people out there that said the government didn't get the acreage right, and some are arguing that we'll see actually higher corn and soybean acres because we missed the 2.5 to 3 million acres of CRP acres that came in last year. That's a debate, and unfortunately, this is one of my upsets with the government. They should have already had that announced sometime in July, but we still have to wait for that in the October report. So that's a guessing game, and unfortunately, I don't know how to guess on that one.
What else before we let you go?
Have a safe day, both in the field and on the highway, and have a profitable day.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Have a good day.
That's Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services, and he is in Oakland, Illinois. In agricultural news, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson offered no timetable again for her agency's decision on allowing 15% blends of ethanol. Speaking to about 90 people at Growth Energy's legislative conference, Jackson said the timetable to make a decision on Growth Energy's waiver request that would allow blenders to sell E15 ethanol continues to hinge on the Department of Energy completing its testing on vehicles. Final test results on 2007 and newer automobiles are scheduled to be done by the end of the month. The DOE also is continuing to test 2001 to 2006 models of vehicles, but that testing won't be completed until the end of November. USDA says despite a late summer surge in wheat prices, landowners offered to enroll 1.5% of U.S. cropland in a federal program that pays them an annual rent for taking fragile land out of production. Some 4.3 million acres will be accepted of 4.8 million acres offered for the conservation reserve. Texas, Colorado, and Kansas, all part of the Wheat Belt, are the leading states for acceptance. Congressional investigators say the Iowa egg farm at the center of a massive salmonella outbreak received hundreds of positive results for salmonella in the 2 years before its eggs sickened more than 1,500 people. The House Energy and Commerce Committee said its investigators had obtained records showing Wright County Egg received 426 positive results for salmonella between 2008 and 2010. According to the committee, the company received as many as 67 positive results this year alone. The owner of Wright County Egg, Austin Jack DeCoster, is scheduled to testify before the panel next week. USDA says it has discovered that Chicago-based Samco Incorporated, a subsidiary of Brazil's JBSSA, the world's largest beef producer, has continued to import banned beef from a Brazilian production facility. About 258,000 pounds of cooked beef are being recalled because they were made at a Brazilian plant that previously produced meat contaminated with high levels of a deworming cattle drug. The recall includes cans of Libby's corned beef shipped to retail stores in Florida and Pennsylvania, Kroger corned beef in Indiana, Brushy Creek roast beef in California, New Jersey, Missouri, and Texas, and Brushy Creek shredded beef in Missouri, New Jersey, and Ohio. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. There is a number in the latest USDA reports that many in the industry find curious. It relates, as Todd Gleason reports, to what's left over from last year's corn crop. He spoke with agricultural economist Daryl Good about the numbers.
Yeah, I don't have any argument with their numbers.
That's Daryl Good discussing the new numbers from the United States Department of Agriculture. It's the old numbers he finds unique.
One thing that's still curious that we've been talking about for some time is still on the old crop, the what appears to be a very large feed and residual use of corn, kind of out of line with where we've been on feed use and where USDA thinks we're going. This past year looks to be awfully big on feed and residual use.
The University of Illinois Ag Economist is looking forward to finding out why the feed and residual number from the 2009 corn crop is so big. He'll get an answer in this month's quarterly grain stocks report.
Wherever stocks come in, then we can calculate backwards and see what that feed and residual was. Does it verify or not? But other than that number, everything looks logical at this point. That one stands out a little bit as being unexplainable. But
there is noise in the number, and it might not change, admits Good. He says that's just one of the few options.
You think of three or four scenarios that could happen. One is we find corn in the September report, which suggests that feed and residual use wasn't as large as we thought. And so we come in with a bigger-than-expected September 1 stocks number. We come in as projected on September 1 stocks, and USDA doesn't change their feed and residual use. Just we live with it and say that's the noise in those numbers. Or at a real low-probability scenario would be that we confirm the projected September 1 stocks or come in even a little smaller, which then would perhaps force some revision of the size of the 2009 crop.
That last option is very unlikely, says Good. The new number will show up officially in the October USDA reports, but can be calculated from the September stocks report. If it does not change, some have argued it will reflect a need to feed more bushels of the poor quality 09 corn crop to achieve the same weight gain per day per animal. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Joining us now with cash grain analysis is Matt Kunisch of the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Well, I suppose a line out of a famous book, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times in terms of what you're trying to do with corn these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is good with the moisture compared to last year, though, and a lot of farmers are very happy about that.
I suppose. Also, you're trying to deal with beans, though. I meant the timing of it all. I bet you have beans and corn.
It is a bit tricky this time of year, corn and beans coming in at the same time. You know, if you have, as long as you have a plan ahead of time, the problem is for a lot of places we'll be getting rail cars at opportune times to be able to keep their doors open. If they don't get the rail cars, they will be closed. So you just really got to be prepared for that.
I was going to ask you, how difficult has it been getting cars booked?
Getting them booked is difficult. It depends on if you did it a month ago, you're probably okay. If you're trying to do it today, you're probably struggling.
So what are farmers who show up at the elevator saying about the quality of the crop, the yield of their crop? Are they happy? Are they angry? What's going on?
Well, I've had kind of a wide range here on the beans. I have not heard any complaints. The quality has been very, very good. That's all I'll say about that one. On the corn, you know, if you go west of us or southeast of us, there are some definite problems with the crop as far as size of the crop, some pretty low yields. And then you get closer to the plant here, and even north of the plant, then we're seeing more normal, maybe down, you know, 5-10% compared to last year. Not record breaking by any means, but still not a bad year either.
Is it surprising to you this year that the rally on the board is running counter seasonal?
You know, normally I would say yes, but compared to the last couple of years and what's going on with the world right now, I'm not completely surprised. I am surprised about the beans, but on the corn and the wheat, not completely surprised right now.
What do you expect basis to do over the next 2 weeks?
Over the next 2 weeks, I believe I would consider corn and beans to be bearish for the next 2 weeks. I think once we get into the second week of October, I believe those will come charging back. But with a glut of corn and beans moving at the same time, processors will only be able to handle so much. Rail loaders will get bogged down, will get cheap, and then once that moves through the processors and we're you know able to get cars and move some of that grain, I believe, you know, late October, early November at least, the beans and corn gets pretty strong there.
Let's have your prices then today.
Delphi corn today at $4.60, Climbers corn at $4.60, and Delphi beans at $10.10.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Kunisch of the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. And in about 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at the agricultural weather with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. It's National Creme de Menthe Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1879, Frank Luntz was born, and American entomologist, museum curator, educator, conservationist, and writer. He was one of the leading U.S. entomologists of the first half of the 20th century. He taught that insects were an integral part of the environment. In 1898, William S. Burroughs died, an American inventor. Burroughs invented and manufactured the first adding machine with a printer. In 1904, the first balloon used for meteorological research in the U.S. was released in St. Louis, Missouri. The balloon carried instruments that would return to Earth when the balloon burst. Since the first launch, literally millions of weather balloons have been launched by the National Weather Service and its predecessor organizations. And in 1965, the Green Acres TV show debuted. Running until 1971, the show featured the yearnings of want-to-be farmer attorney Oliver Wendell Douglas, who purchased Sight Unseen, a 160-acre farm in Hooterville. By the way, one of our favorite episodes has Douglas's wife Lisa telling the folks of Hooterville that her husband was a ruthless cow killer. And that's this day in agricultural history. Listening to the Closing Market Report, this is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Good afternoon, Drew.
Good afternoon, Dave.
There is a series of rain events that is expected to happen over the next several days. Can you tell us about them?
Yes, they're going to be a frustration for farmers, especially in the western portions of the Corn Belt. I think places like Iowa and Minnesota, Wisconsin, and maybe northern Illinois and northern Missouri will all be grouped together in their aggravation over the fact that we've got these three systems lined up to move across the region. I'm not totally convinced there's just going to be three of them. The first disturbance is already in place here today, and we'll find that system moving on into the eastern Midwest as we go through the night tonight and into the day on Thursday. This event will likely set off about a half inch of moisture in a general manner, but there will be some half inch to 1.5 inch amounts up in the far northwestern part of the Corn Belt, up in Minnesota again, and parts of Wisconsin possibly, and there may be a little band of heavier rain that comes out of northern Missouri into northern Illinois, and that too will produce at least a half inch to an inch of rain, if not a local amount to an inch and a half in a couple of counties there. The system will weaken as it moves further to the east, so we'll see probably a half inch or less, maybe a couple of local amounts, maybe up around 3/4 of an inch. Now, that system will be in and out of the region fairly quickly. The next system that will show up will be the leading edge of much colder air that will be debuting in the northwestern Corn Belt on Thursday afternoon into Friday. And that system will likely produce some drizzle and light shower activity in the northwestern Corn Belt, but stay out of the eastern belt at least into Saturday. There will eventually be showers that will work their way southward through parts of Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas, and eventually across the Mississippi River into Indiana, Ohio, parts of Illinois as well, as we get into Friday night, Saturday, and maybe Saturday night. And we'll see drizzle and showers with that event, and moisture totals will run up to about 3 or 4/10 of an inch. Not a lot of moisture, but just, again, a little bit more aggravation. After that, another storm system, in fact, two of them, will come back-to-back during the week next week that will produce more rain, and it will be focused on the northwest half to two-thirds of the Midwest rather than the Ohio River Valley, where we'll still see some net drying.
Taken in total, then, would you anticipate that there should be some slowdowns in the harvest?
Absolutely. And not only that, but there will be a little bit of concern maybe over the quality of a few crops out there, although I really don't think that will be the issue. It's just the delay that we'll be facing. There will also be a little bit of frost up in the far northernmost fringes of the Corn Belt, but this will not be a significant event for the most part. But northern half of Minnesota, parts of northern Wisconsin's crop country, and maybe the eastern Dakotas, getting a little chilly over the weekend with some temperatures in the 30s, maybe a couple of readings colder, but only near the Canada border.
Thanks, Drew.
Have a great afternoon.
Meteorologist Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated. And that is the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, our topic, rural development. We'll talk with Illinois State Director for USDA Rural Development, Colleen Callahan. Ms. Callahan, it is a pleasure to have you on the show in this capacity. Thank you so much for being here.
You are very welcome. Well, if it is a pleasure for you, it is an honor for me in this capacity as Director of USDA Rural Development for Illinois. I welcome every opportunity to share what USDA Rural Development really does and how it works. So I thank you for that that chance.
Much of our audience will be familiar with you as a radio personality and a farm broadcaster, just so that they know you're one and the same, and now you're in rural development at USDA. Let's talk about some of the things that you've been up to since you've taken on the job. I made note off of the website that you were recently learning how to drive a great big truck.
That's right, I was. First of all, one of the reasons that I had the opportunity to learn how to drive that great big rig that you're referring to is that USDA Rural Development is a lender. We have loans and grants, both direct loans and guaranteed loans and grants, in three basic program areas of housing, community facilities, as well as business programs. And under each one of those headings, there are a total of over 40 different programs. And the reference that you made about learning to drive the big rig was at Lakeland Community College, where we were able to work with them with our funding to help them secure the software that's needed and the program that's needed to help students learn how to drive one of those big rigs. And so you're driving it virtually, but of course it seems like you're right in the seat.
Are these grants or are they loans, combination thereof?
This was a combination, and oftentimes it is just that. It typically is a combination of grant and loan. And there's never as much grant money as there is loan money, but it is usually a combination of the two.
How much money did you loan out last year, do you know?
We average throughout rural Illinois $1.8 million every day. Every day we are able to assist with projects and programs that benefit our rural community throughout Illinois on an average of $1.8 million every day. And we're pretty efficient at doing it because it's 1.5 cents administrative cost per dollar delivered.
And those are loans. What kind of payback do you have on them?
It depends on the program, Todd. In housing, it depends on if it's a guaranteed loan, if it's a direct loan. And let's say in the water program, as an example, which we were talking about, the water programs are for communities that are 10,000 and under in population. The housing and the community facilities programs are for communities that are 20,000 and under, and our business programs are for communities that are 50,000 and under in population. Now, that wasn't your question, but it needs to be established that that's the baseline that is used. And then when it comes to the grants, once you've determined that a community qualifies, then for grant purposes, you have to begin to do the work on the average household income. And the higher the average household income is in a community, the less grant money is available. And so it would follow that the lower the average household income, the more grant money is available. So there's a bit of a formula to it that you have to work through that would determine how much grant versus how much low-interest loan money would be available. And then when you say, well, what would be the interest rate on that, there's another variable. If you are one of our three counties in Illinois that is classified as a perennial poverty county, then the interest rate is going to be the absolute lowest at 1%. In other areas, it may be 2 or 3%, or it may be 4%. But they are all very low-interest loans, lower than what you would find at a traditional lending institution. And in the water program, again, as an example, these loans are spread out over 40 years. And so when you're talking a low-interest loan over 40 years, it makes it possible for these communities to pay that money back because they have a longer period of time to do it, and they have less cash outlay over time to do so.
Can you tell me just a bit more about the breadth of rural development and the kinds of loans? Because you're putting out $1.8 million a day. There are three primary areas. We've touched on two of them at this point, but maybe if you could give us an idea of what kinds of things you see that come through the office and that you help to fund, whether that's through a grant or a loan, because it must be extraordinarily wide-ranging.
Well, it certainly is. And when you consider the needs that communities have, let's just start there. With rural development funding through the loans and grants, whether it's direct or guaranteed, or whether it's a combination of a loan and a grant along with it, let's take a community that needs infrastructure improvement. And let's take Rossville as an example, where we were able, through our business program area, through what's called an RBOG, it's a Rural Business Enterprise Grant. That's a $99,000 grant in that instance that Rossville applied for, was reviewed, they received it, and they're utilizing that money to improve their sidewalks, their streets. They can use that money to improve the facades of their main street on those buildings. We have another program where a revolving loan fund can be established through a grant program. And the community can apply for that. And then that money is theirs to utilize as they recognize is needed in their community. So when a business may come to them and they need some startup money, then that community can offer that money to that entity for that purpose. And the community can say, well, we'd like 2% interest on this loan. What that does then is perpetuate that fund so that the community can then help other businesses that may come to them that has a need. We assist with hospitals, brand new hospitals, hospital extensions or expansions, telemedicine, libraries, community facilities if there is a need for that very entity, a community facility, a community building. If there are fire sirens that are needed or storm sirens that are needed or fire trucks or police cars, all of those come under our community programs area. When you talk about housing, we have programs that span from individuals who may need assistance with buying a home. And if they are in a income category that qualifies for, say, a 1% direct loan or maybe a no down payment loan, we're able to assist in that manner. Or we can guarantee a loan that has been made at a lending institution of their choice, which means that it gives them an opportunity to do something that they otherwise might not have been able to do. If you travel through a community, say, in Milford, Illinois, and you see an apartment complex there, it may be that USDA Rural Development 30 years ago helped fund that multifamily housing project, and we're still in the process of helping that community maintain that project, along with the owner who came to us for funding to build it. And some of those, of course, include some subsidies for some of our retirees or needs because of whatever misfortune someone may have had and has limited income, they still need a place to live. And so USDA Rural Development can assist in that kind of a project as well. in the business programs just a few days ago when Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack was in Illinois, he spent a great deal of time in Morton at RMH Foods, which years ago was Roki's Meeting House, and it was just a little local locker. And then another generation came in, and they decided to do some value-added work, and then another generation came in, and they said, gee, maybe we could work on some meat products that were fully cooked and didn't take too much time then to prepare for a full meal. Well, that was very successful, and Smithfield Foods recognized it, and they came in and purchased RMH Foods in Morton. And then about a year or so ago, Smithfield announced that they were going to spin off some of these acquisitions. And the Roki family went to their local lender and said that they'd like to buy this company back. They'd like to be able to keep it in the community, retain the 133 jobs that go along with it. And so then that local lender came to Rural Development and said, would you guarantee this loan? And through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus package, we were able to, yes, guarantee that loan. We were able to guarantee it at 90%. And when the secretary was in Morton to tour the facility and meet the family and the people that they put together to come together to provide also some funding on their own to keep it together, it spanned a whole nother conversation about how we look at our food system as it relates to the school lunch program. And so when the secretary asked John Roki if they had products that could possibly be used in school programs that were lower in fat and lower in salt, and he said yes, that was the next wave of what they were working on, they now have built a relationship and may possibly at least come to the table for discussion about how a company like that may be able to help in that manner. So for the short time that I've been involved with USDA Rural Development since July 13th of last year, I have come to realize that what Rural Development does is help people. There isn't a day goes by that we don't help someone in some way. And that's the true essence of public service. So I hope those are a few examples that maybe give it a little more flavoring rather than just dollars and cents and qualifications about the kinds of differences that rural development can help make in our rural communities.
What we're really talking about, I suppose, is to some extent a transfer of wealth in some form or another, whether it's through the grants. Sometimes loans, of course, are paid back, but they're low-interest loans. So it's a transfer of wealth from one set of taxpayers to the others. Is there a U.S. government counterpart to rural development for the urban areas?
What I like to say about USDA Rural Development is that we are a lot like the SBA, the Small Business Administration. And I have said this in the presence of SBA personnel. When I say we are like the SBA, the Small Business Administration, only we're better because we focus exclusively on rural communities. And we are a lot like the FHA, the Federal Housing Authority, except we're better because we focus exclusively on rural communities. So, yes, there are counterparts, and those would be two that first come to my mind.
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. More on our conversation with Illinois State Director of the Rural Development Program for USDA, Colleen Callahan, in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, China's state-owned Sinochem Corporation appears today unwilling to make a bid for Potash Corporation, even as Beijing voiced concern over BHP's $39 billion bid for the Canadian firm. Sinochem would instead consider buying some of Potash Corporation's assets, such as its nitrogen or phosphates businesses. China, which typically buys about 7% of the output of Potash Corporation, the world's largest fertilizer maker, fears a BHP takeover might push up the cost of fertilizers, crucial to boosting food production for its huge population. Kroger Company's net income and revenue rose in its second quarter as cost-cutting and efforts to build customer loyalty against tough competition boosted results at the nation's largest traditional grocer. The company says net income was $261.6 million, or 41 cents a share. That's up 2.8% from $254.4 million, or 39 cents a share a year ago. The nation's farmers markets are attracting few food stamp users, despite a widespread effort to reach out to low-income shoppers. About one-fourth of the nation's 6,000 or so farmers markets accept food stamps, but the USDA says less than one-tenth of 1% of SNAP benefits redeemed last year went to farmers markets. It says 82% went to grocery stores and super centers. And that's a look at today's business news.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest is the State Director for USDA Rural Development in Illinois, Colleen Callahan. Ms. Callahan, are funds from Congress hard to come by for rural development programs?
Well, I'm so new that I haven't experienced that phase of the process yet, but certainly am about to with discussions of the 2011 budget and the conversation that began just very recently on the 2012 Farm Bill. So I can't really speak to that from any previous reference. However, I can tell you that the Secretary of Agriculture rarely misses an opportunity wherever he is speaking and to whatever group it may be to underscore the need for us to think about the future of our rural communities as it relates to production agriculture. Because, Todd, you know very well from all of the interviews that you have done over the years about how rapidly our technology has taken us to a very consistent increase in productivity. And so we are able to feed the world, if you will. One farmer feeds hundreds of people, not just a few people. And I'm not here to debate where that raw product should go, whether it should go to food or fuel. That's not where I want to focus. What I want to focus on, that no matter where that raw product goes, that at least in the Midwest, we have become so efficient and so specialized that we plant in the spring to wait in the summer to harvest in the fall, to wait in the winter to plant in the spring to wait in the summer to harvest in the fall, because we can. And what that also means is that a very high percentage of our production agriculturalists have off-farm jobs. And if there are no off-farm jobs in those rural communities, that jeopardizes potentially that level of productivity. And so that means that it is the rural development arm of USDA that has the responsibility to assist our rural communities to make sure that we have done our part for jobs to be available for production agriculture as off-farm opportunities. But it can't stop there. That's the basis. That's the foundation. If we just do that, it could become a zero-sum game if we don't do the next leg of it, and that's assist in bringing in broadband to those communities to attract young people to either stay or return to those communities for its lifeblood. So when you say, does Congress debate the allocation of funding for rural development? Yes, they do. And it will become all part of the discussion on the allocation of funding for USDA in general. USDA Rural Development is one of the entities within USDA, along with FSA and risk management and, of course, food and nutrition. And again, as you well know, the highest percentage of expenditures and allocation in USDA is for food and nutrition. USDA rural development is really a very small portion of the allocation in USDA. So we're going to have to see where literally the chips fall as it relates to rural development funding going forward. But I do know, as I started out saying, that this Secretary of Agriculture is always very quick to talk about the significance of rural development and the role that it plays in the future of agriculture, that I'm confident that he will continue to send that message wherever he is. And that's not to take away from production agriculture, but to help create the foundation for it to be maintained and to thrive.
We would be amiss if we did not discuss how it is that people apply for the grants and the loans. Where do they go?
We have 12 offices throughout Illinois. There are 13 total. The state office is located in Champaign, not far from the Country Fair Shopping Center. There are two USDA buildings there, and Rural Development is sharing that location with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. There is also one of our area offices located in Champaign. And then we have in that area Effingham as well as Pontiac. And then you get further north, and we have Princeton and Oregon and Ottawa. And then you come around the horn a little bit, and then we're talking Galesburg and Jacksonville and Quincy. And then in the more southern part of the state, we have Edwardsville and Mount Vernon as well as Marion. So there are 125 employees throughout Illinois that are devoted to administering the rural development programs as they relate to lending and the needs that exist throughout rural Illinois. You can go to the USDA website, and you can just go to USDA Rural Development. That'll get you there. You can put USDA Rural Development, Illinois, that will get you there very specifically, but it's www.rurdev.usda.gov and then a / and IL. But again, Google it, USDA Rural Development, and it'll pop up.
Colleen Callahan is Illinois State Director for USDA Rural Development. You've been listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good day.